Let's call this committee to order. And we don't have a quorum, so I think maybe we will just go ahead with our presentations. In your folders, members, there's a copy of House Research Publication Long-Term Care Services for the Elderly by Dana. Thank you very much. Danielle.
Did I say Dana?
Oh, sorry about that, Danielle. I first. Anyway, Ms. Pinelli, would you like to take a moment to walk the committee through that document, that would be appreciated.
Sure, Madam Chair and members. This is just an update of a publication that's been around for a few years, Long-Term Care Services for the Elderly. Looks like this. It basically just is a description of some of the bigger programs that are administered by the Department of Human Services and also the Minnesota Board on Aging that serve the elderly in Minnesota. So I just thought maybe putting it in the packets and pointing it out would be helpful for members, and it would be something that you could use just kind of as a resource.
Okay. Thank you. It is complicated, the whole services, so as everyone knows. Members, I thought that it would be helpful today to learn more about elderly waiver and home and community-based services, since there are several bills we'll be hearing potentially to about these topics. So I thought it would be good for us to all have a background on the programs and services. So with that, we have Minnesota Board on Aging and local area agencies on aging. I wanted to make sure that the committee members knew about these valuable local resources and learn about the role that they play in the communities with helping those who are aging. There's a lot of different services that we have. So finally, the other thing that we were going to do was have long-term care insurance, but it didn't work out for them today, so we'll reschedule that and see when they can come in. So anyway, welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair and members, good morning. Thank you. It's good to be back to provide some more information for all of you. Hopefully it will be helpful in your discussions regarding home and community-based services and long-term services and supports for older adults. My name is Carrie Benson. I'm the Director of Aging and Adult Services at the Department of Human Services, and I'm also the Executive Director of the Minnesota Board on Aging. So I will be, can you hear me okay? Okay. I will be speaking today about the range of services, as Danielle said, the range of services that support older adults in their homes in community settings, and it accounts for about 3/4 of the older adults that the Continuing Care Administration at the Department of Human Services serves overall, as far as the overall long-term services and support system. So I'll be focusing on those older adults who receive one or more of these home and community-based services. We are very proud as a state of our ranking, according to at least the AARP scorecard, that a couple of times that they've done the scorecard so far, we have ranked first as a state in the nation regarding our long-term services and support system, and that's broadly defined as far as for older adults and people with disabilities. You might remember from the hearing last week that we talked about the timeline, the history of the many decades of work that has gone into developing the system of supports for older adults in particular, and there were pieces there related to people with disabilities as well. And so we know that it's been a very deliberate, incremental effort over the years that has led to such a strong services range of services and supports for older adults. And so I will be touching on that, but wanted to celebrate the status that we have of our system today, and knowing that moving forward, you know, changes will need to be made, improvements, enhancements. There's still gaps, you know, amongst the various range of options, and I'll talk about those too as I go forward. We all know that the population is aging. I do find, though, that this this slide is very useful in terms of just kind of grabbing our attention as far as the immediacy of the change that we will start to really see and that will start to impact our system of services for older adults, but our state as a whole. I mean, all aspects of our lives will really be impacted by the aging of the population. And the change, this transition has already begun, but we'll start to really see the impact on our programs over the next few years, I would even say, will be even more significant. So the urgency to really take a status check of where we're at now as a system and see what do we need to do as far as investments, redesigns, moving forward to make sure we've got the system in place that we all want to use should we need to. This diagram is very simple, but I hope it helps helps you get a picture or a way of thinking about the range of services and supports. As was already mentioned today, that the system is pretty complicated, and it's hard to really make sense of it. And we've all probably had experiences, you know, trying to navigate the many different programs, different options, finding out about those, and so. We like to just boil it down to this range or continuum of programs that we oversee at the Department of Human Services and the Minnesota Board on Aging. This by no means is to illustrate or to make the point that we feel that people go through this continuum in a straight line, that, you know, it's a very straightforward and linear approach that people take in terms of getting their services. However, one of the things that I like the most about this diagram is that it does allow me to point out that as far as the development of our system over time, we have worked first as a state many decades ago in terms of building the capacity for nursing home services and really, you know, the building of nursing homes and the developments and enhancements over the years. So that's really where we started as a state. And then as you move to the left of the diagram, you can see then we put into place elderly waiver, alternative care, most recently essential community supports, and then we do have the Older Americans Act programs too. One of the other things this diagram shows is that in terms of the Older Americans Act services, as an example, that they provide really the lightest end of services or the lightest touch of services for older adults who need some supports at home, some services, just starting to need some help. Maybe their family caregivers are starting to need some help. And so that's a way to be looking at this diagram also, that you go from that lighter end, lighter touch of services all the way to the what can be pretty intensive services provided in a nursing home setting. One other thing to note on the diagram is the cross-cutting piece on the bottom on caregiver supports, that we really want to make sure we call out the major role that family caregivers play in providing supports to older adults, no matter where they live and what other supports they may be receiving. And so we really try to, throughout our programs, plug in the publicly funded supports that we administer to really enhance, really support the assistance already provided by family members. We don't want to get in the way of that, but we want to support the family members in their role, but also just plug in the gaps as we can. So we really make that a key facet of our system as well. I want to just touch on the Survey of Older Minnesotans because I want to share a few facts that we have from that, a few of the results from that survey that we conducted, especially most recently, related to family caregivers, just to give you an updated snapshot of where we're at as far as the amount of care and assistance that's provided by family members. The Survey of Older Minnesotans is a survey that we conduct every 5 to 10 years, depending on resource availability. It's a survey conducted by the Minnesota Board on Aging and Department of Human Services. And we ask a very large range of questions of adults that we survey. The most recent iteration in 2015, we surveyed 4,000 adults age 50 and older about a range of topics in their lives currently, and then also asking them about their thoughts for the future in terms of should they need long-term services and supports, or what their thoughts are about continuing work or retirement or those types of things. One of the areas we asked about is both for people who needed help, who said they need some help around the house. Typically, they're in the older age groups of the survey respondents that we surveyed. And we asked them, if you need some help, who provides that help to you? And it was a little over 70% of the survey respondents said that they received that help from a family member or friend. So that's pretty significant as far as the percentage of overall help that's received by older adults. Surprisingly, we in fact find that this percentage is increasing, the percentage of people who are providing support to their family members or a friend or a neighbor that they're helping out. We're surprised by that because one of the predictions we had made earlier on when we were anticipating the aging of the population, the impact that that could have, would have on our system, we anticipated that, you know, we're not literally not going to have the numbers of people available for providing this informal care. So far, we're seeing that that's not playing out, that people still are stepping up, but just in different ways, that they're plugging in and helping out as they can. Oftentimes, more individuals are involved in providing support. We're even seeing from other sources, not this particular survey, but we're seeing from other sources that younger family members are getting more involved than maybe we had seen in the past. So some really interesting trends, and we feel pretty positive about that might bode well for, you know, going into the future in the next, you know, especially 10 to 15 years as far as the willingness for family members to step in. However, we do have some statistics on this slide that do note that for some family members, depending on the level of need of their relative, that it really can take a toll on them, and the stress level, the burden, the challenges that they face just juggling that in their daily lives can be pretty dramatic. And in particular, for people who are providing supports to a family member with memory loss, that can present particular challenges for them. And so you'll hear in just a couple of minutes here about some the area that we focus on quite a bit, especially through the Older Americans Act programs, to really plug in memory care-related interventions, services, really trying to get those supports to family members, providing support to individuals who are struggling with memory loss. And so you'll see there's a few other statistics on here, too, about just there's subgroups of caregivers that we're focusing in on and need to address as we go forward.
Excuse me, Ms. Yes. Benson. I think we have a question. Representative Allen.
And I can hold it to the end if we'd prefer to do questions then, Madam Chair, or now, whichever you'd prefer.
I think that would be okay. I think we're going to have plenty of time. So
go ahead.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you. So could you speak to that trend of why individuals are providing more care for family members? Is it due to better education around the, you know, continuum of things, you know, aging with dignity and choices people now have? Is it due to financial reasons? Can you speak to any of why this trend is happening, that more family is providing care?
Ms. Benson.
Madam Chair and member, we're not entirely sure why we're seeing that trend taking place with family caregiving. We have some thoughts about that. I think it does go to one of the points you were making about increased awareness and education, about just awareness of aging and the role of families that is becoming more a part of, we would say not enough of, but more part of the dialogue as a society. But we also feel that it's really family members deciding they're going to step up and that they're going to take it on, maybe not just as a sole caregiver, that there's some different thinking about, from the, and it's really the younger boomers that are doing this, that, you know, they're saying, okay, we've got to take care of mom or dad, and we really want to make that work for them as well as we can, and they're really taking a pretty proactive role, and so we're seeing kind of a generational difference too. Related to that is the generational difference that I was mentioning about the millennials, younger individuals, that they're stepping in and not necessarily providing, you know, a lot of hours or really intensive help, but they're plugging in as they can. So we're seeing, you know, the use of technology to help families, you know, coordinate. And really family caregivers stepping up as advocates and really, you know, pushing the system to say, okay, we need certain things, you know, for mom, for dad, for my spouse, for my partner that I really want to see in a certain way, and really a growing voice, which we hope continues too. So a lot to be seen, I think, still on that one.
Thank you, Representative. I think I said Allen, but Representative Olson. Sorry,
I didn't
about
even
that.
Catch that, Madam Chair. Thank you. That was helpful.
Okay. So, anybody else have any other questions? Well, then we'll let Ms. Benson continue.
Okay. This next diagram that we're looking at is Minnesota's Aging Network, as we call it. This is a diagram that we use to also help make folks make sense of the system of long-term services and supports in a particular slice of that system. This is the system that is primarily funded through the Older Americans Act. So that's the funds that I had mentioned just a few moments ago that provide that lighter end of services for older adults as they are starting to need some help in their own home, in the community. You'll see at the top of the network diagram here, the Minnesota Board on Aging. And the Minnesota Board on Aging is the designated state unit on aging to receive the federal Older Americans Act from the federal government, Administration for Community Living. We receive the Older Americans Act funds and then distribute those to the 7 area agencies on aging. They in turn enter into contracts with service providers in their regions to deliver the services that are outlined in the Older Americans Act. And then the service providers deliver the services. And so we've got the different layers of the aging network in place. And examples of the range of services that are provided as funded by the Older Americans Act. I will go into a little bit more detail on the services in just a moment, but I do want to just spend a few more moments talking about the Minnesota Board on Aging. And as I said, they are the state-designated entity to receive the federal Older Americans Act funds. So that's a very significant role that they play in terms of administering those funds and making the best use of them to serve individuals who are not yet eligible for other state and federally funded programs. So we really try to target in those services. However, their other roles are equally important in terms of their role in advising other state agencies, external entities in terms of the aging of the population, best practices, the latest research in the area of aging. And then they also provide advocacy in regards to best models to serve older adults, promising practices, innovations, and those types of things. So those are the three roles for the Minnesota Board on Aging. They translate pretty directly into the roles of the Minnesota Area Agencies on Aging. And I wanted to spend some time on the roles of the Area Agencies on Aging and really encourage you all to reach out to your local Area Agency on Aging to learn more about the work that they do. They play a very important role in their regions in terms of really being a hub for information and assistance. They manage, in partnership with the board, they manage the senior linkage line, so they operate a regional call center in each of their regions to respond to calls by older adults, family members who are trying to figure out what options might be available, what services might be available to them in their communities, and reach a lot of people with that type of service, as well as helping people in transition between settings where there's a particular, you know, concerns, particular challenges in terms of making sense of those options. But they also provide information and technical assistance support to a broad range of entities in their regions. They are tasked with bringing together partners to address the needs in their regions, to identify gaps, to bring folks together and think about what innovative models they might want to implement in their communities, to really be the entity that looks at the system as a whole and really undertakes the efforts and has that leadership role in bringing folks together to address the needs that they're seeing. So they play a very important role in that way as well.
Excuse me, Ms. Benson, just one second. Members, I'm wondering how many of us are, how many of those groups are represented in this committee? Just out of curiosity, could you identify it? Representative Allen, would you mind starting? Which one you live in?
The Metropolitan.
Okay. I would assume.
I presume Metropolitan. I have red, green, okay. Color blindness and can't actually.
Oh, sorry.
I didn't really see it.
That's kind of a problem.
Yeah.
The Arrowhead
area
agency. Okay.
I kind of knew, but I'm part of Land of Dancing Sky. Representative Tice, which one?
Oh, Central.
Central, okay. And Representative Lomer?
I would say Metropolitan.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So there is nobody in the Southeastern grouping and would be the South Central? No. Minnesota River. There we go. Thank you. Has everybody had a chance to contact their area agencies and have conversations with them? Might be something to check into. Mine makes sure it contacts me quite often. So anyway, go ahead, Ms. Benson.
Madam Chair, thank you. You gave me a chance to realize that I wanted to explain, too, that as far as the area agencies on aging, the six that are listed first on your slide in terms of the bullet points are the six that are geographically located. We talk about that they cover those regions that you see shaded on the map. And then we do have the Minnesota Indian Area Agency on Aging that serves the tribes in the northern part of the state, the four tribal communities, and they provide a little bit of a different range of services, a little bit more focused on providing direct services to their Native American elders in those communities, and also do provide, you know, quite a bit of assistance and information to families and family caregivers. So they perform a very important role for those Indian communities in the northern part of the state.
Ms. Benson, we have a question. Representative Lomer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Ms. Benson. I'm just curious how folks find out about all of these things. You know, say my parents are just sitting home and you know, needing some help. How are they going to learn about your services? What ways do you have to get your information out to folks?
Ms. Benson.
Madam Chair and member, I really appreciate that that question, because we work really hard on that in terms of getting the word out. So with the Senior Linkage Line being a 1-800 toll-free number, you can call it from anywhere in the state, actually in the country too, we really focus on just getting that number out there so folks know about it and know that they can call. And they can call with questions about the Older Americans Act services, but really any services and supports that they might be in need of accessing. So any of the programs that I'll be talking about today, they would have information about, as well as decision support tools. We typically call them basically tools that they can use to walk through some questions to help folks think about, okay, I'm living at home and I need some help. How do I think about that? How do I start making sense of what my options are. How do I think about, you know, can I pay for them myself? Do I need to think about maybe I'm eligible for a public program? And they help people just really walk through and navigate that. We also have a website called MinnesotaHelp.info that basically is the same database used by the staff that answer the senior linkage line. So that's a wealth of information on the services and supports that are available to older adults in communities around the state. And so if you're a family member, older adult yourself needing services, if you're a service provider, we actually have a lot of healthcare providers that that use that service and access the website. We make it available and try to make it as easy as possible for folks to navigate.
Representative Lohmer.
Madam Chair. So do you advertise on television or something? Like, I'm just, you know, curious how, and you know, some folks probably aren't on the Internet if they're maybe in their 80s or 90s or something. So, you know, how, if they don't have a family member or something, how would they know about you?
Ms. Benson.
Madam Chair and Representative. We do advertise on television. We have a number of different ways we advertise. Right now, we currently have a campaign underway with Care 11 News, where we're putting in some segments during the news hours, and then they also focus in some content, especially for boomers, for the sandwich generation. The baby boomers are both caring for older adult family members and caring for younger family members as well. And so that's a an example of one of the ways that we've done the television advertising. But we do get the word out in a lot of different ways that are not as obvious, but we do get the word out through local partners as well, through print material. We have that available, of course, at our service locations, but we also try to get that out into community locations as well. We do a lot of advertising on the radio. We have billboard spots. We have seen an increase in the percentage of people who, through the survey of older Minnesotans, indicate that they know about the senior linkage line, and then an increase in the proportion of those individuals who say that they call, but it's still pretty low. So we, you know, we continue to work at that and are always looking for new ways that we can use the limited dollars that we do have that we can devote to that awareness raising piece, that we can really get the biggest bang for our buck.
Ms. Benson, I would also like to mention, don't you work through,
really saves them money. You know, we get federal medical assistance or Medicaid dollars, it's called at the federal level, for the alternative care program. That's because we have made the argument to them that it saves them money by preventing or delaying individuals from spending down into the elderly waiver program. So that was just a recent enhancement that we were able to make to really bolster the capacity of that program to serve individuals and to be able to bring more resources into our system. So we were pretty excited about that and really find that this program is an important one to help individuals with those few services, a handful of services that they need. Cost per person per month, you'll see, is a little bit higher than we had in the Essential Community Supports Program. Again, providing a little bit more intensive services. Moving on to the elderly.
Excuse me. That's okay. Representative Tice.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess I'm just thinking about the alternative care program. And, you know, it's such a, being a senior is such a weird thing because Perkins sees me as a senior and I can order off their senior menu. But yeah, when it comes to services, you have to be 65. And so you've got this group that, you know, you hear, I guess I'm maybe because I'm just older, I'm a senior according to Perkins. You know, you hear of more early onset, Alzheimer's and some other ailments. What is available for folks in that range where they're not old enough to receive this, but do they have similar things for folks that have what I would call an older person's
issue or disease or what have you.
Ms. Benson.
Madam Chair, Representative, we do work with partners around the state to try to address those areas of need. Because we are constrained by the eligibility requirements, you know, even with the Older Americans Act being 60 plus, boy, there's oftentimes we wish we could reach people earlier. Because each individual situation, of course, is unique. And so, it, as you said, you know, memory loss is a good one, that there's individuals who do experience that at earlier ages. And so to be able to plug that in, plug in those services and supports. And so we do try to work then with other partners who do reach younger ages. And so we make available our programs, our services to the populations that we can. And then we partner with other organizations to make sure they know about these programs and services so that if they are able to support financially, you know, individuals who are younger to participate, we very much look for those opportunities. If they can get information and education out that maybe we've developed for the older adult population, but and we have it and we're doing our work with it, but if they can make use of it too, great. You know, so we try to really share, you know, especially in the area of best practices, programs, we try to really raise the awareness in that way. The eligibility criteria, I would say, for the Federal Older Americans Act, just a note on that, there's a criteria that does allow us to reach family caregivers at earlier ages. So there's a little bit of wiggle room in there, and we really capitalize on that. Overall, we see that we do serve people on average at an earlier age through the Older Americans Act, and then we see it creeping up as we go along that continuum of programs where we're serving people who are older and needing that more intensive service. So it is an area where we do continue to work on that.
Representative Tice?
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Benson. You can go ahead.
And for the Elderly Waiver Program, I will move on to that. You also have a fact sheet on the Elderly Waiver Program. And this is the program where we're serving individuals who are needing a pretty intensive level of service, but they really are interested in receiving those services in their own home or potentially in an assisted living setting. And so this is, as I said earlier, the first program that was put into place by the state as an alternative to the nursing homes that were available statewide. And so we literally needed to go as a state to the federal government to ask for a waiver on the payment of medical assistance to nursing facilities. And that was quite a few years ago. But it's the reason why we call it the name that we call it. The Elderly Waiver is literally because we received a waiver from the federal government to provide that. You'll see that we serve over 20,000 individuals a year through this program. On average, I'm sorry, per month, a little over 20,000, and about 28,000 people served over a given year. People typically use Elderly Waiver services for about 18 months. We often talk about it as a program that serves people at the end of their life. You know, that people are often really wanting to stay in their own home if that's where they're receiving services, or if they're in an assisted living facility, and of course then that becomes their home, that they're really wanting to stay there and receive services to the end of their life. And so it's really that critical program that provides that that support for them. As I mentioned at the hearing last week, a little over 40% of the individuals who we serve through the Elderly Waiver Program do receive services called customized living in assisted living settings. So we talked about that package of services. We've seen that percentage growing over the years since customized living was added into the Elderly Waiver Program. And we see that people are moving to those settings quite a bit when they're in need of services, and so we need to make sure that they also know that there are other options as well in those services in their communities. The Elderly Waiver Program
most of the people that receive services through that program receive services managed through the managed care organizations. So about 93% of individuals are served through managed care. And that's through a special program called the Minnesota Senior Health Options that brings together both the Medicare and Medicaid-funded services for older adults and really serves to help older adults make sense of that range of services, the complexities of Medicare, as well as then their services through medical assistance. And so I wanted to at least highlight that for you, that that's a key component of the Elderly Waiver Program. The home care program is the last one that I will be talking about in terms of the range of home and community-based services programs provided to older adults in the state that are either state or federally funded. The home care program provides medical and health-related services, assistance with day-to-day activities to people in their homes. And so this is a service that provides home care, personal care assistance, or nursing services. Maybe it's therapies, physical therapy, occupational therapy, and those types of services in an individual's home. Average people per month is a little over 30,000 people. And individuals who receive home care, nursing, and or PCA services can also be receiving services through the Elderly Waiver Program. So I say that as a way to say that these are individuals who need a pretty intensive level of service. And oftentimes it's, for the home care piece of it, it's that short-term service that they might need to plug in to get more intensity post-hospital discharge or those types of situations.
Excuse me, Ms. Benson. When we're looking at the statistics on this, is this just considering the 32,000 people, just people that are over 60 or over 65? Or because there's a whole group of people that receive home care that are not older?
Madam Chair, yes. It is people over the age of 65.
Okay. So there's a whole other number of group that receives. Okay. Thank you.
All right, so stepping back from the details of the programs, we do track various measures, various data points to see how are we doing as a state. You know, how are we doing in terms of meeting the needs and preferences of older adults, of family members to provide services in the way that people would most prefer. And again, most people do prefer to live in their own home, and we're doing pretty good in terms of supporting people in that way. We find that nursing home facility costs about 2.5 times more than community services on average. So as a state payer, you know, we're very interested in being as cost effective as possible, especially because it tends to match right up with people's preferences for where they would like to receive services. So as I've talked about before, we do see nursing home utilization by people in our oldest age group declining over the years, and we see the rise of individuals receiving services more so in their home and community-based, in their home or in community-based settings. About 75% of older adults who receive long-term services and supports do receive home community-based services and account for about half of the spending. So in contrast to that, then, we have the other quarter of the population, of the older adult population served through our programs, that are receiving services in nursing homes and account for about half of the spending. So just an interesting dichotomy there to show where we're at as a system. Average monthly cost by program is another way. The taller bar is the average monthly cost for nursing homes, followed by the Elderly Waiver and the Alternative Care Program. So as our population ages, we're seeing, you know, of course, trend lines showing that we expect costs to increase because of the sheer number, the increase in the number of people eligible for our programs. And we see the nursing facility costs and the other costs rising at about the same rate, although we've been able to make some dents in that in different ways too. Relatedly, in terms of making a dent in the overall cost of the programs, we do see that we are able to serve people with higher levels of need in the elderly waiver and alternative care programs. And that's been a very big focus of our work in partnership with the lead agencies, the counties, the tribes, the managed care organizations to really work with folks to say, okay, what is your preference? How would you like to receive services? If it's in your own home, let's really work to make that happen and really plug in the programs that can help them do that. And so we're able to keep people on the programs, get them into the programs with those higher need levels. Next, I would like to shift gears and talk about, just for a little bit, the work that we're doing to develop the capacity in our system to provide home and community-based services options. Again, these are options that we're wanting to make available to individuals, whether they are private pay individuals, whether they are eligible for one of our programs. And so we've worked quite a bit through the Livable at Home grant program to make these options available. And I am hoping I can maybe make this video work because we really like it, and I think it tells it better than I can in terms of the impact of these grant projects on the for the people that we serve. So we'll see. No? I'm looking to my technical assistant here.
That's just fine.
Oh, there it is. Oh, very good. Or not. Well, I guess that was just a teaser that maybe you all will be really compelled to click on the link when I send it to you, maybe, instead. So
we'd appreciate that.
I was really hoping that would work, but it was brief, a brief video that we have, and I can send the link if you would like, but really just puts a human face to the work that we do, and we're so proud of the work of the local grantees around the state that we've supported through this program, and they've over the years have just done amazing things in terms of really building the capacity of their communities to support older adults. And so we'll follow up with that as opposed to you having to sit here watching us try to make that work. The Livable at Home grant program, I mentioned it briefly at the hearing last week, and mentioned that it's a competitive RFP process that we go through every year, so it's an annual process. This year, pending legislative approval, we anticipate having about $8 million for grants to communities, and these are grants that are available to local organizations in a couple of few different categories that I will go over here. And organizations that are interested in addressing a gap in services or addressing a gap in housing and services for their older adult population can make an application for a grant under this program. The area agencies on aging, the regional entities we talked about earlier, have a particular focus on providing, through their elder care development partnerships, they have a focus on providing assistance to organizations who are interested in thinking through what grant proposal they might want to make for this program and really helping them come together with other potential partners and really think through, okay, what would that need to look like and how can we make this a reality and really bring that together for them. In terms of the categories of the grants, we have a category for capital and renovation requests, and those are requests that can be made for funds to either build
new housing for older adults focused on affordable housing for older adults that then services can get plugged into for people to support their aging in place. But it also can include renovation. And we've done quite a bit of both over the years in that we've used the funds to really help enhance the buildings that have been built, you know, decades ago as far as the low-income senior housing, where we've really provided that maintenance, the upkeep, the renovations to allow aging in place a little easier, and the retrofitting as well. So we do provide support for that and really focused on helping people who are living in these settings or who could with low and moderate incomes and with their chronic health conditions. Retrofitting should produce savings for older adults as it reduces their costs for medical care and other services. So there's always that tie where we're really trying to look at what's the most cost-effective investment we can make in these capital and renovation requests. In terms of long-term services and supports development grants and the core home and community-based services, these are focused more on the service side of the system. So these are focused on addressing gaps in service availability in a particular community, even within a city, maybe really focusing in a neighborhood area, or developing new models, innovative models that a community might want to make available and really test out and try out something new. And so in particular, the long-term services and supports category, with that higher dollar amount, that it provides quite a range of opportunity for local organizations. The core home and community-based services category is available to organizations, I should say, that are outlined in the state statute that authorizes this program. So there are particular types of organizations that are listed. These are all more the smaller nonprofit organizations, really local level organizations, such as the Faith in Action organizations, Living at Home Network organizations, or Living at Home Block Nurse programs, congregate nurse programs, but also programs that fit the same type of criteria and characteristics as those smaller organizations. And so there's some criteria in the RFP for that, where we're really trying to bolster the capacity of these small nonprofit. You know, they may have, you know, one or two staff people and really rely a great deal on volunteer capacity to deliver services in their communities to older adults and family members who really want to remain in their own home. So they provide funding to organizations that fit this category to provide that administrative capacity as well as that service capacity for them. I wanted to provide just a few examples on the grants that we've been able to support through this program. One of them is a program effort underway in Cook County. We identified Cook County at the hearing last week as a county that does not have an assisted living facility. And there was some discussion about, well, why is that? And so I wanted to provide a little bit of the story behind one of our grantees, that is the Care Partners of Cook County is the name of the organization. They applied for funding originally in 2011, and since then have applied for and received additional grants. And what they've really done is responded to the needs in their local community. So they started with a small grant to provide palliative care, hospice care, end-of-life care, because they saw that was noted as a gap in their community. It was noted as a gap in our biannual gaps analysis survey process, where we document that type of thing as well. And that's where they started, and they got that underway. But then they started seeing other needs in their community, and they stepped up to build their capacity to meet those needs. So now they also provide caregiver consultation or counseling and other supports for caregivers, including respite services. They provide companion services, health promotion. So they provide, they deliver some of our self-management programs, evidence-based health promotion programs. And then they also most recently identified a need for transportation service. And so they worked with partners in their community to add that service also and really make that available. Again, with a focus on providing those services largely through the use of volunteers and really really calling on neighbors, helping neighbors and volunteers in the community. So it's a great example of the many projects that we see around the state where it's a very local effort, locally driven, and staffed, literally, volunteer staffed locally, and is very responsive to the changing needs. Another example that I wanted to provide to you is on the capital and renovation side of the grant program, and that's a senior housing building in Hibbing that is managed by Avinity and providing services through there too, through Avinity. They added in, and this is in St. Louis County, they added in health sensing and health monitoring technology into the building to further support aging in place. So this is a building where the adults living there now had moved in, you know, at least several years ago, if not even, you know, more than a decade ago, where they've lived there many years. They want to stay there. They don't want to have to move to a nursing home. And so the providers are figuring out how they can plug in, of course, the additional services that are available through our programs, but also what else could they do to really support that aging in place. And so they've stepped up the technology provided to have health monitoring technology available in each of the apartment units. And then that the information through that health monitoring technology is available to the healthcare providers as well as the family members. Of course, this is at the request and the allowance, you know, of the older adults in each of the apartments in that building. But if they're interested in having that available, making it easier for their family member to help them keep track of their medications, help them keep track of different vital signs or different health characteristics that they're tracking for their chronic conditions, they can have this technology in place, and it really has started to make a difference already. The project coordinator works with the caregivers on using what they see as a HealthSense dashboard. So they're receiving this in their computer and can see this dashboard so that they can see if they if the reminders for medications, if other things are happening as they need to throughout the day. And they can see changes in the their loved one's condition earlier on that can alert them to maybe a need to connect with their healthcare provider. So still a lot more to learn with this project and with a few others, too, that are using similar types of technology, both to connect the older adult socially, you know, to make it easier for them to connect with family, friends, literally to see their church service remotely, for example, but also then to be better, more easily connected to their healthcare provider and their family caregivers for their health needs as well. One last example that I would like to provide to you is an adult day program that was just added, that was expanded, I should say, in the Bemidji area, I believe this was. Oh, I'm sorry, the Waseca area of the state, and they added in, it's an elder circle provider, and they added onto their program for adult day, they added more caregiver support services because they're really seeing a need for this service, in particular respite. And that's been a challenge for us to be able to have the capacity needed to provide respite when a caregiver really needs it. And on an intermittent basis, on a not scheduled basis, because oftentimes there's a need maybe for crisis respite, or there's just a need for respite maybe over overnight or on the weekend. And we're trying to figure out ways where we can really build the capacity both of volunteers to provide respite that's more socially oriented, more like a companion service, as well as medical respite services too. So there's a number of things that we've got underway, but the Elder Circle program, they're really trying to maximize their ability to really use volunteers to provide respite, and they've provided training to their respite volunteers through a program that's been underway for a while nationally, a best practice model called the REST program. So it provides the respite volunteers with the tools they can use to go into the home and be able to engage with the older adults and be able to meet their needs while also being a well-trained and supported volunteer, so that really eases the mind of the caregiver as well. So they know that this person has been thoroughly vetted, thoroughly trained, and is ready to provide that service and support to the older adults. So we will be doing more of that work as well in terms of really both identifying individuals who are willing and able to provide that respite care, but then providing them with additional supports to further engage them in their work. So we'll see that work in Elder Circle continue to expand, too, as they really play a leadership role in their community. And with that, I'd like to end there.
Well, thank you, Ms. Benson. Members, does anyone have any questions for Ms. Benson at this time?
Representative Lohmer.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Ms. Benson, great presentation. How do you go about getting your volunteers? Where do they come from? How do you recruit them? Talk a little bit about that, please. Maybe the Senior Expo is a good place, but in my area I haven't seen that, so I'm just wondering how people find out about that.
Ms. Benson.
Madam Chair and Representative, that's a great question. I think that's one of those areas where we're always looking for, you know, the next best strategy to recruit volunteers. You know, we do it in a variety of ways. It actually does happen a lot of times at senior expos and community gatherings. We do a lot of it by word of mouth, just through community organizations that where people can hear about the need for volunteers and the ability to get involved with their community. Each of our grantees through the Livable at Home grant program, our providers, I mean, they try to get the word out through their websites, through social media. We provide a lot of support in terms of really branching into more of the social media, and that seems to be getting a lot more attention lately, too, to get people involved, and especially to offer them a way to be involved that works for them, so that it's not just a one-size-fits-all, that they have to volunteer, you know, in for a whole day to provide, you know, a chore service or homemaker service to somebody that, that you know, is very rigidly scheduled or, you know, takes a lot of time. What we try to do is provide flexible options to folks so that they can plug in where they're most interested and needed. So we do a lot of that as far as the volunteer matching and the services that way. One area where we find we can really catch people is when they are either within their caregiving role as a family caregiver, we can start helping them think about who can they tap in their community, who can they call on to that might be able to help them out. We also see that after they are done with their caregiving role, oftentimes it's because their older loved one has passed away. After that, they might really still feel that they want to be a part of the caregiving effort and helping their community. So it really comes out in a lot of different ways. And so we just really work with our local communities to really try a variety of methods.
Representative Lohmer, okay. Thank you, Ms. Benson. I appreciate that. Members, we have not approved the minutes yet for January 18th, so I think we have a quorum. Thank you. Representative Freiberg, sorry about that. Representative Freiberg moves the approval of minutes for January 18th. Any additions, corrections, or changes?
Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay. Motion prevails and minutes are approved. Thank you. We got that. So we have another presentation, correct? Okay. Ms. Natterud is going to join us and talk about Own Your Future. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Please identify yourself for the record.
Yes, my name is Larae Kanatarud. I'm Director of Aging Transformation at the Minnesota Department of Human Services in the Continuing Care Administration.
Thank you.
I'll just proceed.
Go right ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In addition to having all the information about the services and the programs that the department administers and brings out to local communities, it was felt that we probably should say something about the efforts we're making to try and change some of the financing of all of these services. And we have an effort that we call Own Your Future that has been around since 2012, trying to identify and enable individuals to plan for their own long-term care, including how to pay for it. And this is, of course, important because as we look to the future and we see the huge age wave of the baby boomers, we'll have another age wave with the millennials when they get to be that age. In addition to having those age waves, we've also seen a dramatic increase in life expectancy. And so people are living longer, and that means that they often experience the need for long-term care. And so the Own Your Future effort began in 2012 with the governor sending a letter to people in Minnesota between ages 40 and 65, urging them to start looking at the issue of long-term care and having a plan and also looking at how they might pay for it. This is important not only because of this huge age wave, but because most people are unable to really afford the high levels of long-term care that they may need later in their life. And so to take a look at how people can do better planning, how we can maybe look at developing additional financial products so that more people would be able to afford their own long-term care. One of the demographic realities is that if we project out into the future for what the state Medicaid budget might be, by 2040 we could be looking at an increase from $1 billion now per year to about $4 billion per year for long-term care for the elderly. And so there are reasons in addition to helping people have a better quality of life, but also budgetary reasons for why we need to take a look at this. So since 2012 and the letter went out, we have been doing a number of public awareness activities. We have a consumer's guide that we have distributed. I have to say that we made 50,000 copies of these, and we only have about 2,000 left. So I feel very good about getting that into the hands of a lot of people to help them plan. People are not in the habit of thinking about how they will pay for their long-term care. This is something that we have to kind of educate people about so that as they're looking at their retirement planning, part of that has to include how are they going to provide and pay for their long-term care. Because families provide the vast majority of care, most older people don't really have to think about the affordability until after the family is unable to provide more care. Either there is more care needed or the family is not in the same area. They have other issues that they have to deal with. And so at that point is when people start looking at the formal care system, having to pay for a home care agency, having to pay for other kinds of services that would come into the home or for assisted living or a nursing home. So what we've done in this Own Your Future effort is, in addition to the public awareness, one of our other objectives was to look at more product development. When we looked, we have an advisory committee that includes many stakeholders throughout the state, advocates, and we also work with several state agencies on these issues. But as we looked at the products that were available, we realized that there really wasn't anything for the middle-income households, which is really most of us. People who are wealthy can afford to self-fund, and people who are very low-income have Medicaid as their safety net. But for the rest of us, there aren't a lot of products that are affordable. And so one of the things that we've been working on and followed by the work of a subgroup from our advisory panel that identified 15 different options that might be available for how to pay for long-term care. And on the fact sheet on the Own Your Future, if you look at the back page, we have listed the different kinds of options that subgroup put together. And in our looking at that list and figuring out where to start, we identified two that we felt had the most potential in terms of universality and affordability and the use of private sector, not together with public sector. And we focused on two products that we're still continuing to work on. One of them is a term life insurance product that you buy when you're working for breadwinner protection, and that converts into a long-term care insurance product when you retire or when you get to a certain age later in your life. This has proven to have a very affordable in terms of some of the preliminary actuary analysis, and so we're continuing to work on some of the issues there. The other product that also seemed attractive is the idea of adding home care benefits to the supplemental Medicare policies that are sold in Minnesota. We have found out through our work that 3/4 of people on Medicare do purchase supplemental plans. They see that as being a necessity in order to protect them from the co-pays and the deductibles in Medicare. And so if we had the requirement that a small home care benefit would be a part of that, you would be able to provide coverage to a very high number of Minnesotans who are on Medicare now and would be able to help them pay because it would be covered as a part of the plan. So those two ideas are ideas that we're continuing to work on. And I believe there's one other there should be one other slide here. The things that we're working on in terms of those products to do kind of the due diligence include the actuarial soundness, the analysis of what the premium would be and how that would be, you know, what portion the premium would pay for in terms of the life insurance or the long-term care insurance, or in the case of the Medicare, the various home care services. We're also doing studies to gauge consumer interest to find out, you know, if there's a market out there. And we've done some very quick anecdotal things at the state fair, for example, and we found that there is some interest among individuals for the kinds of things that they could purchase and use and have more control over the, you know, the money that they spend on long-term care. The other thing that we're doing is taking a look at a broader economic impact, and we're working with SHADAC, which is a part of the School of Public Health. It's an agency that helps state agencies around the country with their use of data to do analysis on the healthcare system. And we're working with them to do a projection model that will help us take a look at a variety of these options to see how it saves Medicaid, Medicare, how it affects out-of-pocket spending, private insurance, those kinds of things, so that we have a better sense of which of the options that are available to the legislature and to us as a state would be the most affordable for the state, for the person, and so on and so forth. We're also looking at regulatory issues. The Department of Commerce is one of the groups that works with us on the Own Your Future, and we're also working with the Medicare people at the national level to see how this benefit could be approved and made available. So we're busy, we hope, trying to find some new ways to help individuals pay for the services that they probably are going to need in their old age. And with that, I'll see if you have any questions. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Nataru. Does anyone have any questions for Ms. Nataru? Well, I thank you for your presentation and for coming. Members, our next meeting is Wednesday, February 1st. We're hoping to start hearing bills next week. So with that, we are adjourned.